Adam cab share. Just one block away, there's a train station, SkyTrain, runs every 5 minutes to the airport. It's $3.75, takes 25 minutes to get caught in traffic. If you're interested, anyone in the hotel, anyone in that building can point you to how to get a ticket for it. So it's my pleasure to introduce Stephen Downs. Stephen is a very unusual character. In many ways, the archetypal Canadian, the archetypal member of the Canadian National Research Council. If you look in the bio book, you can see, in some sense, a small subset of who he is and what he's done in his life. All sorts of things that aren't in here, some of which are academic, like he's sort of an all but dissertation philosophy PhD student in epistemology. He's been a teacher, a newspaper editor, but all sorts of other eclectic things as well. A hot dog vendor, a 7-Eleven clerk, a dishwasher, a telephone installer, a security guard, all sorts of things that essentially, when we were talking about the sort of pluralistic network, Stephen is a pluralistic network of one. Even though he and I disagree a little bit technically about the whether it's connectionist networks all the way down, I think we're all going to enjoy this talk. Stephen.
Hey, well, hello, everyone. I'm going to jump right into things here. I like to go to watch stand-up comedy every New Year's Eve in Halifax, which is about a 3-hour drive down the road. And last year we saw a Canadian comedian called Mike Bullard. He's probably most well known for having a fairly dull talk show, but his show at the New Year's Eve festival was a scream. And one of the things that he said that show stuck with me. And what it was is the secret to comedy, like everyone else, or assume everyone else, I have this closet stand-up comedian inside me, although you notice I did not start off with a joke. There's good reasons for that. And so I listened attentively. Bullard said, the secret to comedy is find something that you have in common with the audience, and then bring them around to see your own point of view and make them laugh at themselves. And then you proceeded for the next hour to do exactly that. And what struck me as important in that particular remark is that it shows an awareness that the humor is in the listener. The funny is not in the joke. The funny is not in the comedian. The funny is in the person who's actually doing the laughing. I think we have to take that as our starting point when we begin to talk about things like knowledge and learning networks and peer networks. Today I'm going to talk about learning networks. And what do I mean by learning networks? It's one of those delightful phrases that has two meanings. On one hand, I mean using networks to learn. But on the other hand, I mean networks that learn. And so when I'm talking about learning networks, what I'm talking about is using networks that learn in order to learn and in order to help networks that learn, learn. This will become a bit clearer as I go along. Now, people wonder what I do with the National Research Council. The National Research Council is like a national university, except without students, and there are 1,700 or so researchers. They're all like me. They're all highly individual and eccentric. And it's a very interesting place to work. One of the things that we've been working on recently, you can see the URL in the corner there, ple.elg.ca, is something called the personal learning environment. And what the personal learning environment is intended to be is, on the one hand, an approach to providing learning so that people can take charge of their own learning and get learning from a wide variety of producers or vendors or resources, and on the other hand, an attempt to instantiate some of the principles of the learning network. And we've been using prototype personal learning environments in order to run online courses of our own. One course that we're running right now is called PLANK. Great acronym, stands for Personal Learning Environments, Networks, and Knowledge. And PLANK is what we call a MOOC, or a massive open online course. And you see from the diagram there, that's the course structure. And it probably doesn't look like the course structure from courses that you took when you were in university. It looks actually kind of like a mess. But the idea is that the course itself is a network. The people in the course are parts of that network, and the course itself consists of interactions and activities taking place in this network. Now, we've been running these courses, myself, George Siemens, Dave Cormier, Rita Kopp, and a number of other people, for a few years now. We started off with a course called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge in 2008. That attracted 2,200 people. PLANK is just a small one by comparison. We've got about 1,500 people in it. And what we're finding is that this system of learning works, although it works in our own funny way of defining how things work. Now, the topic of this conference is peer learning and peer networks, and there are efforts to understand the principles of peer networks, but you know, in the closing comments yesterday, there was discussion, there's a fair amount of maps, and what we saw were a lot of topologies. And from my perspective, what we've seen thus far in this conference are surface phenomena, and that's why we're seeing so many maps. And the attempts that are being made to understand these network phenomena, these peer networks, thus far have been attempts to understand them using yesterday's values. And I just list a few of them there: power, trust, incentive, propagation, broadcast, messaging, content, the usual things. And what I want to do with this talk is to move beyond those usual things, to move beyond trying to understand peer networks in terms of industrial age concepts, and understand networks for what they are. So right off the bat, let's challenge some of the conceptions. We talked about collective intelligence, and collective is a funny word. Collective is a word that makes us think of masses. It makes us think of piles, makes us think of elements. I'd rather use connective intelligence. David Reed said yesterday, the power of peers in the peer. But I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, really? Is the power of the brain in the neuron? Is the power of a sandcastle in the grain of sand? I guess sandcastles don't have power, but we'll leave that aside. No, what's important here is not simply the number and the nature of the elements making up the system, but rather the organization of the system itself. The sand pile is not, or sandcastle is not just a pile of sand. If it was just a pile of sand, nobody would care. What's really important about a sandcastle is the way it's organized. And we don't understand society or networks or peer networks just by looking at the individuals that constitute those networks. What is important about those networks is the way they're organized, is the way those individuals are connected to each other, communicate, and interact with each other. Now, George and Dave and Rita and I and a bunch of other people follow what we loosely call connectivism. And connectivism is, at first blush, a theory about learning, and at second blush, a theory about knowledge. And it borrows, just to anticipate, it borrows a lot from other theories. It borrows from connectivism, it borrows from constructivism and constructionism, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And I will say, other people have thought about all of this first, so I'm not claiming any sort of primacy here. But what's important is in getting at the right sort of concept of what knowledge is. Because if we're going to understand how people learn, how networks learn, we need to understand what it is that they're actually doing when they're learning. So according to connectivism, which I say is the theory that George and I and the rest put together, knowledge is distributed across a network of connections. And learning is the ability to traverse and grow those networks. Now, that sounds, at this point, like complete gobbledygook. But let me cash that out. In a connectivist course, there is no curriculum. There is no body of knowledge. Or, well, there is, sort of, but that's not the point of the course. The content, if you will, is the MacGuffin. A MacGuffin is a device used in fiction around which the whole plot revolves. In the Maltese Falcon was the MacGuffin. Could have been the Jade Statue or whatever, but it was the Maltese Falcon. It didn't really matter what the Maltese Falcon was. What mattered was that there was something that everybody was chasing. And that's the case in a connectivist course. The content is the MacGuffin. It doesn't matter what the content is. It matters that everybody's chasing around some sort of content. The product of the course is not the retention or the absorbing or the memorization of some sort of content. The product of the learning is the learner. And specifically, the mental capacities that are developed as a result of the process of taking the course. I'm reminded at this point of what Fernando Flores was saying about emotional fortitude, or similarly what other people have talked about under the heading of 21st century skills. That sort of thing. It's not that there's nothing to learn. There's lots to learn. There's piles of stuff to learn. Rather, it's that what there is to learn is complex. And you can't get at it just by adducing principles, memorizing facts, identifying foundational first principles. Content that is complex is not something that needs to be absorbed. It's something that needs to be navigated. And Douglas Rushkoff hit on this when he talked about the web and similar phenomena a number of years ago now in Siberia, where he talked about the attitude of people who are learning to work with the internet and similar things as surfing. And you know, when you're surfing, you don't try to memorize the wave. You don't even try to memorize wave forms or anything like that. That's not what surfing is about. Surfing is about learning how to navigate in this rapidly changing, complex environment. And learning in a connectivist course is like learning how to navigate in rapidly changing, evolving domains or disciplines. Part of the work that I do involves building tools to accomplish that sort of thing. One of the tools that I built is called a Grasshopper. That link right there isn't working at the moment, so if you give me a couple of days, I'll make it work again. The idea of Grasshopper is that it allows us to be a node in a network. It allows us to function within the network by interacting with other people in the network. It's like what Craig Newmark said. You know, I listen to other people, I repeat what they said. And that is the essence of operating, of functioning in a network. In a connectivist style course, as I said, we function as nodes in these networks. And what that means most precisely, and this is what creates the description for the sort of tool that I'm talking about, is that we aggregate, we remix, we repurpose, and we feed forward. By aggregate, what I mean is we get information, content, data, whatever, from other people with whom we are connected in the network. By remix, what I mean is that we put this together in new and novel ways. So people have been talking about mashups. Mashing up is a way of remixing. By repurposing, what we do is we take this and we give it our own unique perspective. Again, as Craig said, I tell people things, then what I said comes back to me in a different form. That's repurposing. And then you feed forward. You let it go. You put it out there onto the network. And as Craig says, get out of the way. The idea here, the theory here that we're working on is that the learner develops his or her own neural net, his or her own set of connections between individual neurons by participating in the social net. And then the social net, in turn, is developed through the process of these individuals interacting with it. So it's a back and forth kind of thing. Although I'll point to this in a few moments, we want to be careful to keep them separate. And this is a point where people really get confused, and it's easy to get confused on this. The social network is not the same as the neural network. The properties of the social network are not the same as the properties of the neural network. Things that exist in the social network, like artifacts, books, meanings, do not necessarily exist in a neural network. You can't take something like a book that exists, or blog post, or tweet that exists on a social network, and put it into a brain. Brains aren't the sort of things that can hold those things. Brains hold connections between neurons. They don't hold words and objects and artifacts. So we have, really, two kinds of knowledge at work here. One type of knowledge is knowledge that can be called social knowledge. That is the knowledge that is held in a social network. Another type of knowledge is knowledge that is to be called personal knowledge, and those of you who have read Polanyi will recognize the term. And that is the kind of knowledge that we have in our head. Social knowledge is explicit. Personal knowledge is ineffable. Two separate things. But what's interesting about these things, and what's really important, I think, about approaching learning in this way, is that they are both underpinned by a common set of principles, a common set of principles of networks and network interaction. One of these principles that, in my mind, is fundamental is self-organization. And I had a neat video here, but I knew I wouldn't have time to show a 5-minute video, so I won't try to show the 5-minute video. But what happens, if you take separate things, things that are autonomous, like those two metronomes, and set them off running at different speeds or different times, so you know, one's doing one thing, the other's doing another thing, and you connect them, as you see there, with a piece of wood sitting on top of the Coke cans. What happens is these metronomes start off different, but eventually sync together. And this is a well-known and repeatable phenomenon. It's described in a number of publications, Duncan J. Watts, Alfred Lesmel, Barabasky, and others. And it's the idea of self-organizing principle of networks. And there's a link there to the video. This slideshow should be available with the other slideshows for this conference. You can follow all those links at the bottom. Self-organization is a fundamental principle describing how networks learn. If networks could not organize themselves, then they couldn't learn. They'd be static. They'd be inert. They'd be, well, really boring. And the question is, how do networks learn? And this is a question that has already been answered, or at the very least looked at, by a large number of theorists. There's three major theories of associative learning in networks. This list may not be exhaustive. There's heavy in learning. Like things connect to like things. Reminds us of the diagram that we saw yesterday with the connections between people who use the same terms or have the same interests. That's an expression of Hebbian associationism. There's also what Rummelhart and McClellan call back propagation, which is where you have a network that has been set up with a certain set of connections, and then the network receives feedback, and the feedback propagates back through the network and adjusts and changes all the connections. Or there's a third mechanism called a Boltzmann mechanism, where, to express it a bit casually, you shake the network, and then the network settles into a stable or harmonious set of connections. And then you shake it again, and it does it again, and eventually settles into the most efficient formation possible. These are principles that are known and have been described and expressed mathematically and shown to be principles by which networks organize themselves. And what's significant here is when a network organizes itself, it doesn't need a manager, it doesn't need to be told to organize, it just does it. Now, when we start talking about network learning, we now wonder, well, what constitutes good network learning? We saw some discussion earlier today about trust and verification and all of that. And networks can form connections one way, another way, a different way. What makes one set of connections good and another set of connections bad? Well, one thing I would suggest that is characteristic of a good network is that it avoids cascade phenomena. Now, there are different kinds of cascade phenomena. I've got the tulip bubble on here that everybody's aware of. But, you know, there are other cascade phenomena. A cholera epidemic is a cascade phenomena. A brownout that takes out half of North America's electrical grid is a cascade phenomena. And basically what a cascade phenomena is a runaway propagation of a signal in a network that converts every node of the network to the same state. And when every node of the network is in the same state, there's no communication. Or if there is communication, there's no point because everything has the same thing to say.
So, Stephen, that's an excellent, on your left in the back, that's an excellent introduction to what do we do about these runaway situations looking forward. You know, what advice can you give to this group when they are worried about such phenomena in their very complex networks?
I'm glad you asked that. That's exactly what the rest of this talk is about. So, what characterizes networks that are more susceptible to cascade phenomena is the structure of the network. And again, this can be shown mathematically. I've done work with Daniel Lemire, Seth Paquette, and others to express this mathematically. Here we have your typical network structure, and you've all seen these represented as networks, right? This hub and spoke kind of model. And if you've been reading Clay Shirky and others, you know all about the power law. So you have the big head and the long tail. Very typical, characteristic kind of network, but very susceptible to cascade phenomena. And the reason why they're susceptible to cascade phenomena is because all you have to do is corrupt the hubs. And you corrupt the hubs, the signal propagates in one or two steps. There's nothing to stop it. On the other hand, there's a different kind of network structure, one that looks more like our brain, interestingly, one that looks more like a stable kind of configuration, which is a mesh network. Here's what the quote-unquote power law looks like in a mesh network. You don't have the big spike. The long tail has much more influence. These networks are stable. These networks are much more resistant to cascade phenomena because there's no way to propagate a signal from one or a small number of points to the entire network.
Stephen, I have a question.
Yeah.
I understand
on how, in the case of the HUD and SPIT network, the corrupting the HUD might lead to problems. But even in this kind of network, if I think in terms of, say, some traffic jams are caused by an accident, which would be like HUD and SPIT, but some are just caused by each driver slightly overreacting to what the drivers around and in front of them are doing, which seems like it would be more like this kind of network, but individual nodes overreacting.
Sure. That's an interesting question, actually. I'll have to think about that. So I'll answer it in a bit obliquely by saying you're much more than likely to get traffic jams if your city looks like that than like that, right? So this isn't a guarantee of success. Even this is not a guarantee of success. You still sometimes run into problems. But it's better than this. So, and that's how I'm going to have to answer your question at this point.
Traffic jams happen in a linear space.
Yes.
They have one vector, and that kind of a mesh network has got lots of vectors.
Yeah, I mean, you look at an intersection, there's not a whole lot of choice there. But yeah, I haven't thought about traffic jams. I live in a city of 140,000 people. I take public transit. It's not an issue. Now, one of the things, and please notice I'm being careful how I phrase this, one of the things that characterizes the difference between this and this is that this, but not this, is scale-free. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in a network that is subject to physical constraints, you can't create situations where you have the big spike because it's physically impossible. And this little boat network is a pretty good example of that. You just draw the graph of this network. Every boat is connected to one or more other boats, even the ones on the outside. But you notice there's not really a big spike. Even the most popular boat down there near the beginning is only connected to, I don't know, 5 or 6 boats. Compared to a scale-free network, where you can have one boat connected to 1 million other boats, because there are no physical limitations based on size. Networks that are not limited by these constraints tend to be these hub and spoke networks, and they tend toward what we call network death. There should be lessons in that for people who look at networks based on virtual phenomena, like, say, money or influence. When there are no constraints on the acquisition of money or influence, the tendency is toward network death. So, what are the conditions then? Oh, question?
Would you please explain what you mean by the term network death?
The term network death is the failure of a network to assume new configurations. It's the end of plasticity in a network. It's the failure of the network to be able to form new connections or break connections between its members. It is the situation when the entities of the network are no longer interacting with each other in any meaningful way, but rather are sitting there static. That can include a standing network where signals go back and forth, but nothing changes. But typically, it's a network where you don't even have the signals. That makes sense? So, the physical constraints that lead us toward more stable networks are constraints that tend to place upper limits on things. They are things that tend to mitigate against the creation of the big spike and tend to promote the entities in what we would otherwise call the long tail. There's a bunch of principles that are candidates. All of these are subject to empirical investigation, but you know, we've been running a big empirical investigation for the last 20 or 30 years with the internet, and some of these principles seem to work pretty well.
decentralize, distribute, disintermediate, disaggregate, disintegrate, and there could be more. I'm not claiming to have, you know, some sort of exclusive knowledge of this phenomenon. And then there are what I call the semantic principles. This is the democracy of a network, and from my perspective, it's composed of four essential virtues. Autonomy. The nodes of the network have their own individual values, their own objectives, as opposed to some sort of collective or corporate set of values. Diversity. The idea that each entity in a network has a different perspective, is connected to a different set of other entities, receives different input from external sources. Openness, the idea that there can be traffic in and out of the network. If there are no stimuli to spur network growth, again, that leads to network death. And interaction, the idea that the knowledge in the network is an emergent property of the network, and not the consequence of the knowledge of one entity in the network being propagated to the rest. That's kind of a tricky concept, but only kind of a tricky concept.
So I think another word that you could use to describe some of that adaptability is the word adaptability.
Sure.
Nodes or configurations can change and adapt to the damage that may have been done by some other agent.
Agreed, but within constraints, because you don't want it to adapt by developing a cholera epidemic, right? So within constraints. So physical constraints, but within those physical constraints, conditions that promote adaptability. And these are conditions that promote adaptability. And, you know, again, I'm thinking of Fernando Flores, when he's talking about pluralistic networks, it seems to me that he's talking about the same thing that I'm talking about here.
These all seem to be fundamental biological principles. I mean, if you look at ecology, those are the four hallmarks of the healthy ecosystem.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And this is one of the things, it's not part of this presentation, but one of the things I want to emphasize, because people always ask me, well, what's your evidence for this? Where's all the research on that? Especially in education, because I do learning, and evidence in learning is a horrible thing. It's a horrible mess, which I won't get into. But if we understand that learning and social organizations and ecosystems and the rest are subject to these basic biological principles, which have been fairly well explained by other people who know them a lot better than I do, quite frankly, then you have the evidence, you can transfer the evidence, our knowledge of ecosystems transfers into our knowledge of how a person learns. A person learns in the same way that an ecosystem thrives. It's the same principles. And that's what I've tried to articulate here. And that's why I say in this business takeaway, I had to put that in there because of the drill. These values are not just abstract. They're not just, principles that I've come up with because they seem like fun principles. They represent a shift in business values, and I would say away from things like ownership and control, nod to Craig Newmark again, and toward things like stewardship, agility, and stability. And these principles, and especially the semantic principle, should, in my mind, inform the decisions that you make on a day-to-day basis, from management practice to software purchases. Picture yourself deciding whether to adopt System A or System B. Ask yourself, does it allow for the autonomy of individuals using it? Or does it force them all to use the same kind of system? Or think the same kind of way? Does it promote diversity of input? Is it an open system, or is it closed to input from the rest of the world? Does it allow for emergent knowledge to, emerge Or is it nothing more than a system for broadcasting your message to be replicated in all the receivers? See, it gives you off the top a set of concrete decision points to make or to use when you're making decisions about software purchases. And similarly, I'm not going to go into more detail in 22 seconds, similarly allows you to make other business decisions. So that's what I have to say, and we have 14 seconds for questions.
So I think it's important to comment that the Palo Alto network you showed as being so vulnerable is vulnerable, as you say, to targeted attacks, not random failures. In fact, it's quite robust to random failures. So there's a concept here about, you know, what kind of trouble do you anticipate as opposed to, you know, always bad.
That's an interesting thing. It is vulnerable to targeted attacks, there's no question about that. But it's interesting when you say it's robust against random failures. And it is on a percentage basis. But if you have a random failure that hits one of the nodes, one of the central nodes, it's just the same impact as a targeted attack, right? It's where you get these 100-year phenomena, right? You can have a city that's resilient to floods that happen up to 80 years, but the 100th year flood is the one that destroys it. It's the black swan phenomena. It feels like you're safe. It feels like you're robust, because you survive accident after accident after accident, but you're still vulnerable if the number 100 accident is going to take you down. It's not security.
Stephen, I personally really enjoyed your talk today. Thanks
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Okay.